Today on The Grave Talks, the haunted Garnett House Hotel. You could see it from miles away. The bright light, a beacon, designed to let travelers know of a safe place to stop and rest. Its light glowed like fire in the night sky. The top floor of an antebellum-era hotel, known today. That light is what brought some of the most storied villains and progressive leaders to the Midwest and to its doors over its 160-year history. In the 1870s, the town of Garnett, Kansas, was a crossroads of a new world. Settlers, cowboys, criminals, and the righteous all passed through this now forgotten town. Some notable characters of the day included Wyatt Earp, Bat Masterson, Wild Bill Hickok, Buffalo Bill Cody, Bell Star Jesse James, and many others have all stayed at what was the Garnett House Hotel. Screams in the night have been heard on EVP recordings taken at the haunted Garnett House. One of the most disturbing elements of these screams is that they appear to come from a child. Who is this child, and what that child need remains to be known. However, these screams are far from a one-time occurrence. What is the story of the haunted 1885 Garnett House Hotel? That's what we try to answer on today's episode of The Grave Talks.
Well, the 1858 hotel, or Garnett House Hotel, is located in Garnett, Kansas. It was built in 1858 by D.W. Houston, who was one of the early settlers of Garnett, Kansas. Now, at that time, the area was still sparsely populated by those not Indians, and the population, though, was booming. There was a large influx of people coming from not only the North New England area, but from Missouri, who were kind of competing for the future of the state. At that time, D.W. Houston, of its building, he built the place for his wife. It was a two-up and two-down configuration. They were just building it to be a home right away, but she didn't like the way it swayed in the wind, is what she said. And so there, very soon thereafter, he turned it over to another gentleman named Mr. Teft to become a hotel. And almost from the beginning of it becoming a hotel, he began to add on to the building. And it began to change shape over time. Now, the word is that while people were coming to the region, there were upwards of 20 families staying on this property at a time, inside the building and around the property. And, you know, but those times in the 19th century, those families, I'm sure, were pretty large. The area was pretty rural. And so I don't know how they survived in the Kansas heat, but they did, or if they didn't, we don't know that either. Shortly thereafter, after becoming a hotel, they began to expand on it. It also became the center of the Underground Railroad in that area. Now, a lot of the people that were coming to Garnett during that time were abolitionists from the Northeast. And Mr. Houston, or Colonel Houston, because he was the colonel of the Union Regiment during the Civil War from that area, was one of them. Now, the people that were coming there were also some famous people. One of them notably is the famous abolitionist John Brown, who lived in Osawatomie, which is just north of Garnett. And John Brown was not a pacifist in his beliefs of abolitionism. He believed in live by the sword, die by the sword. And he had a more aggressive stance to abolition, where he was actually in direct conflict with pro-slavery men in the area, as well as in conflict with those from Missouri, who at that time, Missouri was more of a split state than a pure slave state, but there was a lot of slavery in Missouri. And the folks that were in Kansas definitely wanted to stop slavery from coming into Kansas. So he was raiding into Missouri, into farms along the western border of Missouri, and stealing slaves. And they were bringing them to different locations there in Anderson County, Kansas, and then ferrying them up to Canada from there. And the Garnett House, the attic of the Garnett House, is said to be one of those locations where slaves were being taken and hidden before being transported on to Canada.
Now, right on the borderline there between Missouri and Kansas, that was a very contested area as far as their beliefs, correct, on slavery. One was pro, one was not, correct?
Right. The what you had happening, especially during the 1850s, the Civil War kind of started 10 years before in this area. Mm-hmm. Now, the Garnett House is the oldest surviving board and batten Latin plaster structure in the area. So at that time, it was also known as the Lighthouse Hotel because they would put a light up in the shutters and you could see it from 9 miles away. People coming in covered wagons would use that as a beacon to get to Garnett. But at that time, a lot of the people that were coming were either from, like I say, from the east, or they were coming in from Missouri trying to sway the state into the pro-slavery camp.
Okay. Now, as time progressed and as we get more into the early part of the 1900s and such, how did things evolve? Who else came to the hotel? What else happened there?
Well, shortly after, in the early 1860s, it began to grow as a hotel. So it started out as two rooms up, two rooms down, but the building began to expand. So you had this hotel ever growing and different people coming. And a lot of the people that would come, some were doctors that would come from outside the area that would come and practice out of the building for, say, 2 weeks at a time. So you couldn't see a specialist in your kidneys or your heart in that area. At the time, you had to depend on someone coming from Kansas City or St. Louis or something like that. And these doctors would set up shop here in the Garnett House and treat folks in the area. You also had things like famous cowboys that stayed there, especially during the Old West and cattle driving days, like Bat Masterson, Wild Bill Hickok, Buffalo Bill Cody, Wyatt Earp, Bell Starr, rumored Jesse James, because the James brothers did frequent the area. They had a friend who owned a ranch just south of the town of Garnett that was actually a guerrilla camp during the Civil War. The Quantrill's raiders would go there and hide out. But after the war was over, the James brothers were still friends with this guy named Peg Leg Rutledge. And what they did is they built a prefabricated house on his property so they could go down there and kind of live incognito under assumed names, and then nobody would bother them. So it was said that they actually frequented the Garnett House as well, but you never can prove it in writing because they operated incognito.
Now, obviously, a lot of those names associated with some violent stories, some very interesting tales, and some are just that, tales. Some are factual. Was there anything involving any of those characters and the house that stands out?
Well, we know that Buffalo Bill Cody and Wild Bill Hickok came and stayed there at the same time because they were on the first train to Garnett when they opened the train line. Now, it's said that Wild Bill Hickok actually stayed there more than one time during the 1870s, but we know for sure that those two were there simultaneously because it's in the historical research that we've done for the history of Anderson County. They, you know, like I said, this was Old West kind of times in Kansas. Now, you go down to this area now, and it's very laid back. You know, a lot of Mennonites and Dunkards and Amish folks in town. But back in the 1870s and 1880s, Garnett was a lot like Tombstone, where there was no law enforcement, and there were open-air brothels downtown, and there were, you know, shootouts in the streets and that sort of thing. So it was, you know, very much a cattle town back in that era.
Dramatically different than what folks see today or think of today, if they've ever been to the area and don't know the history. As time progresses and we get more out of, I guess, what you would call the Wild West era, how did things progress for the building?
Well, we know that on some of the Kansas plot maps, it's listed as a school for a period in the 1880s. Also during the 1880s, it did change name to the Commercial House instead of the Garnet House because they brought in a manager, a lady from Olathe, Kansas, which is near the Kansas City area. And she ran the Commercial Hotel in Olathe. So she came, her name was Mrs. Simons, and she became Mrs. Putnam thereafter. She married another gentleman in the area, and she transformed it to Commercial House for quite a few years, and it operated under that name. And it kind of operated in a hotel probably to about the turn of the century. Now, this school period, you know, we're not exactly sure how that kind of fits in with the hotel era, but we know it was definitely part of it was listed as a school. And at that time, it had changed hands many times, different owners, and they always kept expanding on it. And the hotel boasted upwards of 15 hotel rooms at its peak. Now there's probably three up, three down as far as what remains. What happened, though, is around the turn of the century, we know that also one thing, another person that were rumored to stay there was Harry Houdini, because him and his wife Bess would come to town and do their spiritualist sessions at the opera house in downtown Garnet before he was a famous escape artist. But about at that end of that time, around the turn of the century, around 1900, the building was split into three pieces. We're not sure how they moved it, but they did. The Garnet House piece that we own currently is one of the three pieces. The other two, one we think has been demolished, and another piece we think sits nearby, but we can't prove it yet. We're still doing the research on that. Now, during that time, the Garnet House became a photography studio for some time. And also it's rumored as it moves up into the 20th century to have become that part that we own, a brothel during Prohibition era. And then, you know, then it kind of becomes private residences in between those times. And then finally in 1950, it's bought by a husband and wife doctors who operate out of there up until the 21st century. So it's been a doctor's office for most of at least half of the 20th century. And that's what most of the area and most of the people in town know it as. Mm-hmm. They don't even really know that it was this hotel that operated back in pre-Civil War and Old West times.
When you talk about a doctor's office and it being that for such a long period of time, would this be a doctor's office, just kind of like an outpatient thing where you go in, get your checkup and then leave? Or was this a care facility where you'd be there for overnight stays? What type of office was it?
Well, they each had their own treatment rooms inside. They also had, we have a laboratory and an X-ray machine. So I think they were treating quite a few different things. They were their own pharmacists as well. Okay. So they were running their own apothecary, so they were able to treat a lot of things. Now, I'm not sure if people stayed there overnight, because there is a there were hospitals in the area, but they were, you know, doing probably some pretty extensive treatments in the building.
Sure. And even if people were not necessarily staying there, a doctor's office, something that could be ripe for energy. It's a place where people, a lot of times, find out very life-changing information while within the walls of those buildings. So I can imagine it would be ripe for a lot of energy that essentially is spread out and pushed out into those rooms while it was operating as the doctor's office. After the doctor's office, was that it? Was that the point where eventually it became nothing, or what was its story beyond that?
Well, what happened was is one of the physicians passed away in around 2009, and then once that happened, the other doctor was no longer practicing because of age. But they had what they did was they had employees that would come stay there and work up until 2016. And what they did is they pretty much did their books and things like that inside the building. So after that, the children of the doctors sold off the properties, and that's where we come into play, and we took over the property after finding it while we were kind of looking at some other historical landmarks to possibly take control of.
Let's talk about the first stories that you've heard, not necessarily experiences that you had with the property relating to the paranormal, but what were the first reported incidents or rumors even that there was something going on with the building? How far back does that go, and what are those stories?
Well, as far as paranormal activity, the stories really only start once we took over. Now, we were looking at the property with the real estate agent, we were in the back laboratory. And this is the first time we're inside the building. And we're standing there talking to her in the lab, and suddenly the door flies open. We hear this little girl's voice say something, and this big breeze blew in through in between us. Now, we look at each other and like, whoa, what was that? And I don't think the real estate agent quite figured out what had happened, but we kind of picked up like, oh, you know, so that's a little girl just yelled out something at us. And that was kind of the first inkling that, you know, there's something going on here. Now, we're still just intrigued at that time by the historical history of the house and, you know, all of the famous people that stayed there. So that was kind of the first paranormal event that happened with us when we were there.
Why were you looking at the house? What was the purpose? Were you looking for? I mean, tell me that. I don't want to make any assumptions. Just tell me why were you there looking for a building to purchase?
Well, you know, we are paranormal investigators, mm-hmm. but we were looking at some other locations. We wanted to have places, you know, to. I have a history background, so I was kind of interested in owning a historical landmark as well. Now, I do a lot of events for historical landmarks in the Kansas City metro area that kind of relate to the Civil War. So I had kind of wanted to have a place where I could kind of put my stamp on and stand up a historic landmark for the future. And we were looking at a school that we were interested in out in rural Kansas and a couple other places. And this place just kind of came out of nowhere. I mean, we were about to pull the trigger on this other location. And all of a sudden, my co-owner, Justin, just kind of says, I'm going to look around. So he looked around and saw this place just popped up in his research that it had become available. And that, you know, that's how we kind of got drawn there.
Were you looking for a building that... Because essentially, if I'm understanding right, you didn't know that it really had any haunting activity going on with it, other than the fact that it's a very old building, a very storied history. If you were to take a guess, you could probably assume there's probably something going on there. But were you just more so going for, I want a historical building to kind of headquarter out of, and maybe we'll get something? Or had there been anything else, any other inklings that this... in fact, could be a haunted building and perfect for what we're looking for at the time?
Yeah, at the time, no, we really didn't know if there was going to be any kind of paranormal activity there. I'm a historian, so I was looking at this kind of from a history point of view, is that, you know, I'm eventually going to be done with my IT career. So I wanted something to do post that. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of, and I have the education, but I don't work in that field. I work in healthcare IT. So I wanted to kind of move in that direction as I got older. So that's kind of my motivation for looking for a historic landmark. And in the Kansas City area where I live, you know, pretty much everything is either owned by the state or maintained or it's already stood up and going. I kind of wanted to stand up a historical landmark mm-hmm. For my future and for the future of the landmark itself. And quite honestly, I think if we hadn't acquired the Garnet House, it probably was going to get the wrecking ball.
Sure. When you got in there and it was now yours, obviously it still had been operated to some extent, at least for paperwork and people still going in and out of the building. What kind of a shape was it in?
The building itself is pretty dilapidated. It's, you know, 160 years old, and it's probably only had minimum maintenance, especially over the last 20 years. The inside was pretty much filled to the brim with medical supplies. The upstairs was chest and neck high with probably 50 years of medical supplies. And we're talking, you know, everything from bottles of chemicals to just pure vitamins, jars and jars of vitamins, to just books, to junk, to whatever have you. It was stacked upstairs. And it took us over 3 months just to clear out the upstairs. So it was quite filled. So that's kind of the condition. It still needs a lot of TLC. We're still kind of getting our initial project going as far as restoration.
Mm-hmm. As you began to spend more time there, once you did purchase it, and obviously you told us about that first moment of that door opening and the little girl laughing, what were some of the other initial experiences that you had that made you know there's something paranormal going on in this building?
Well, the first things that were happening was we would be downstairs and you could definitely hear the sounds of boots going across the floor upstairs. Now, this is at a time when the upstairs is filled with junk. And so there's no room to even hardly walk up there. But you would hear something walking back and forth upstairs. So that was kind of our initial introduction to things that are going on while we're trying to work. The other things you would hear, definitely hear talking upstairs. You'd hear talking behind you. You'd have things walk up to you. And then you would turn around. There'd be nobody there. Or it would just be the two of us. So who else could it be? So you had a lot of that sort of activity going on, and things caught kind of out of the corner of your eye, moving past doorways, knee high, waist high, that sort of thing. That was kind of some of the initial things we had going on when we first took ownership of the property.
A lot of folks are able to describe how they feel when they're in a building, whether they're empathic or not. Some obviously can go in very great detail of their vibes or what they're feeling in a property. How would you describe how you felt with these activities occurring around you? And also tell us where you consider yourself on that scale of being able to pick up on emotions and feelings empathically of things around you.
Well, I think I'm probably more from the science and history background. So for me, I mean, I've been to a lot of places throughout the country, and sometimes you just get that feeling. And to me, the Garnet House is one of those places where sometimes it just feels very normal, like I could lay down and go to sleep. Or sometimes you get that feeling like somebody's coming up behind me and I'm going to turn around. They're not going to be there, but I can hear them. I can feel them. And, you know, I'm getting goosebumps and the hairs on my arm are standing up. And a lot of that happens when you're by yourself. Now, could that be psychology? I'm in this place by myself, possibly, but it's just the amount of stuff you hear that goes on, you know, when you're in there. So you're always constantly hearing things moving about. And, you know, but sometimes, you know, it's very quiet and nothing happens. But these things can happen at any time of the day. It's not just at night.
Tell me more about some of the experiences that you've had there. Have you been able to identify any of the spirits or the ghosts that are there, or have any sort of guess as to who they might be?
Well, what started happening was when we were there, it was really there for labor, and we would have to spend all our time just to work. And so we started kind of taking a little bit of time to explore the paranormal side. So what we were doing is we were leaving like voice activated recorders running while we were gone, then putting in like trail cameras, cameras that, you know, could watch the place while we were gone to see if they picked up anything. And what we started picking up was, while we were gone, was screams, stomping, sounds of someone tearing the room to shreds is one thing we captured. And that, you would come back, though, there would be nothing moved. My co-owner likes to use ping pong balls to kind of see if they would move. We put them in positions and then come back the next day or a couple days later and see if they were gone. We picked up sounds like someone had picked up the ping pong ball and had bounced it off the recorder, and then bounced it downstairs, then bounced it upstairs somewhere else, then bounced it back near the recorder. And that, you know, you have a 6 or 7 or 8 bounces in this audio that you've recorded overnight, yet the ping pong ball's still in that spot where you left it. So what made that sound? You don't know. But it's definitely the sound of a ping pong ball. Other things that happened in the sounds were screams, sounds of water splashing, like with chains, that sort of thing. We found some of the ping pong balls in the attic, which the attic has kind of a storied history because it's definitely had an axe, a possible axe murderer who stayed up there at one time, which is a story we didn't touch on earlier, but we'll touch on that one. That's just all kinds of weirdness in the audio is definitely what we were picking up to begin with.
I want to talk about the axe murder, but before I ask that question, tell me more about the screams and the violence and that sort of sound being picked up. What do you think that is? Is that a conscious entity you think that's doing something in their own dimension, or is it some sort of a residual sound from a previous incident? What's your feelings there?
Well, I think it's a combination of all. I think there's definitely residual things that go on, but I also definitely think there's a lot of intelligence because since then, you know, we've owned the place going on a year and a half. We've had a lot of EVPs, and a lot of them are commentary on what we're doing, you know, what we're saying. Like my co-owner got an EVP once where this deep male voice goes, "What are they looking for?" You know, and we're walking around doing something, you know. So you get things that are commenting on what you're doing and what you're saying. So I think it's a little bit of everything.
Okay. Tell me more about the axe murderer that was in the attic.
Yeah. So back in 1864, during the time when they're around the Battle of Westport, which was, for folks that don't know, there was a huge Civil War battle in the Kansas City area called the Battle of Westport in October of 1864, I believe. And they were retreating south, and they fought another battle just to the east of Garnett area at a battle called Mine Creek, which is a huge cavalry battle, the biggest cavalry battle west of the Mississippi. And during that time, most of the young men in Garnett were gone in the Civil War, with the builder of the Garnett House leading them. D.W. Houston was the colonel of the regiment. But at that time, a lot of people were hiding their valuables in the area, and because they were afraid of Quantrill's raiders attacking the town. So what they did, though, is in doing that, is I think they kind of got anybody who was up to no good possibly interested in what they were hiding. So there was a gentleman who stayed in the attic. He supposedly was Mr. Houston's hand servant. He was African-American. His name was John Warren. And one night in 1864, about the time of the Battle of Mine Creek, there was also a professor in town giving a lecture. He was a phrenology professor, which is the study that the shape of your head determines your intellect. And about two blocks down the street, there was a lady named Mrs. Duren who had a grown daughter. The grown daughter went to the lecture because in those times, if a lecturer came to town, that was a big deal. But Mrs. Duren, the older Mrs. Duren, stayed at home reading by the fire. Well, supposedly, Mr. Warren left his room, which is a finished room. The attic is a finished room in the Garnett House. Went down the street, got an axe from the woodpile, went inside, supposedly hit Mrs. Duren in the back of the head with the blunt end of the axe, had his way with her, and then begun to rob the place. She wakes up, tries to make an escape. He stops her, and then he takes the blade end of the axe to her, pretty much severing her head. And then we don't know if he felt guilty or what happened, but he threw the axe into the woodpile, left the premises without anything, went back to his room and went to sleep. The daughter of Mrs. Duren comes back from the lecture, finds mother, puts out the alarm, and all of a sudden, you know, all the men that are remaining in town put together this commission and kind of a posse, and they start hunting high and low who could have done the crime. Well, somehow they find some bloody clothes and are able to link it back to this gentleman, Mr. Warren. So they send guys up there and they drag him out. They take him down before this commission. And somehow they're able to get a confession out of him. And he is tried for the crime. And then he is hung downtown for that crime at the in the rafters of the unfinished jail. And the note that the history says is that they also gave his head away to the phrenology professor for study and gave his body back to the African-American community for burial. Now, this story made the New York Times in its day, but we're never quite sure, did he really do it? You'll never actually know that, because he would have been, for those times, the perfect scapegoat.
Sure.
For such a crime. But he did hang for the crime. We do know that.
Do you believe that he haunts the house?
You know, I definitely get... I've had a couple psychic mediums who've read the house for me during our investigations, and they all definitely pick up something on an entity that is in the attic and does come down. Now, I have never gotten anybody in an EVP or anything that says, I am John Warren. But there's definitely been things... I had another psychic medium kind of tell me, like, and he didn't know anything about it. And he was kind of like, there's somebody in the attic, and that if you were to, and it has something to do with race. So if you were to say anything negative towards African Americans or anything like that, you would definitely anger this spirit that's up there. So I mean, it's a possibility. You know, is he there all the time? I don't know. But there's definitely a lot of activity that happens in that attic. We hear stuff up there as well, moving about. And you know, people don't like to be up there for very long. That's for sure.
And that could very well be him. And I could see that also sometimes being mistaken for something very dark. But someone, especially if they were accused of a crime they did not commit, I could see that, you know, you could be very angry about that and not be in the greatest of moods or mindsets, and having all of that that connected, and then being trapped or stuck in a building for so long. Let me ask you this, because that kind of touches into an area where people don't feel comfortable. They don't want to stay up there very long. And this is something that I believe does get thrown out far too quickly and too readily, is dark or demonic or anything of that nature. Do you feel there's anything, let's just start with dark, that's in the home beyond what we just talked about with the feelings up there? But is there anything, and that could be a human spirit, just an angry human spirit. Do you think there's anything of that level or darker within the home?
We have had people see pure black shadow figures, mm-hmm. like lean around and look at them through doorways. I've had, you know, psychic mediums tell me there's something dark that resides there and walks around. Like, they call it Mr. Creepy. Mm-hmm. I personally have not seen that. You know, I've had EVPs that were pretty dark there. Things that, you know, screaming of make them stop and things like that. Mm-hmm. Child screams that say things like that. Can that be contributed to a dark entity? Possibly. Is it something residual? That could be possible too. So I'm kind of going on what others are saying that they have seen and felt there. But I mean, I think it's definitely a possibility, because we don't know the total history. With that many people coming and going in this place, and it being a hotel. And when we say old, we say hotel, we're talking like Old West boarding house. So who knows how many people were squeezed into these rooms back in that time. Mm-hmm. So who knows what all events kind of happened in there that we don't know about.
Yeah.
It could be a large laundry list of bad events.
That concludes part one of our interview with Robert Garcia, owner of the Garnett House Hotel. In part two of our interview, available exclusively for Gravekeepers only, we will discuss many more disturbing elements of the haunted Garnett House Hotel, including the story of a woman poisoning her husband with rabbit poison, how she was then imprisoned in the Garnett House before being rescued. Also, the Underground Railroad at the Garnett House. We'll learn how it worked and what happened there. History shows it was once a school, doctor's office, hotel, jail, and brothel. What era do many of the ghosts come from that still inhabit the building? Plus, when the building was broken into three pieces, what happened to those other pieces? And what clues exist to the whereabouts of the one existing piece of the building that still stands to this day? Until next time, for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.
Here's what happened when one journalist reported on DEI programs.
I decided to just focus on the University of Michigan. I obtained internal documents that showed that the school had spent about $250 million on DEI programs. I spent 2 weeks in Ann Arbor talking to everybody I could find. The unintended consequences of these programs, they had sort of left everybody dissatisfied. And this expensive machinery the school had built just imploded. If you're a journalist, you are not on anyone's team. All you're trying to do is figure out as many of the facts as you can gather. The facts are going to guide you to where the story lands. You're not taking sides. I'm Nick Confessori. I'm an investigations reporter for the New York Times.
Journalists like Nick follow the facts wherever they lead. They go where news breaks, get answers firsthand, and publish what they find. That's fact-based reporting. Seek it out if you don't already.